ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Prenuptial agreements, are they always legally watertight, or can they be tossed out by the courts? And what do we know about both the lawyers who write these agreements and the couples who sign them? The High Court of Australia recently handed down a decision that focused on a poorly drafted prenup and to what extent the disgruntled client could sue the lawyers who drafted this leaky document. Jackie Campbell is a partner with Melbourne law firm Forte Family Lawyers. Jackie, tell me about this decision. Who are Mr. and Ms. Daly, and who are our lawyers?
Well, we don't know who our lawyers are because it's a pseudonym. But Mr. and Mrs. Daly are also pseudonyms because in family law proceedings we don't report the names of the parties, really to protect the children. But this case had a tortuous history, many, many judgments delivered by various courts, including appeal judgments, and finally ended up in the High Court.
And so before we get to the High Court, this couple, they met back in 1996. Mr. Daly's lawyers, back in the early 90s, they were these our lawyers. They drafted a binding financial agreement for him. This was signed by both parties in about 2005, I think. And it spelled out how the assets of the couple would be divided if they divorced. But I understand the agreement made no reference to children.
That's correct. And it not only didn't predict the fact that they might have children, but there were some problems in the drafting of the agreement. And I think one of the interesting things about this case is that lawyers actually had five goes at doing the agreement and still didn't get it right. They are quite difficult documents to draft, technically quite difficult sometimes, and this one didn't achieve its purpose.
Okay, so the couple during their 12, 15-year marriage, they had two children and they separated in 2018. Then Ms. Daly sought to set aside the binding financial agreement because she said it made no mention of what would happen in the eventuality that the couple had children. And the judge agreed with that, didn't he?
That's correct. There's specific provision in the Family Law Act to set aside financial agreements in particular circumstances, and one of them is when there's hardship relating to children. And in this agreement, it provided that the parties would get 50-50 of all the property, and there was no uplift for the wife if she ended up having children and therefore was out of the workforce for some years, which actually was what happened. So the husband had gone on working and she was out of the workforce, so she'd lost her income and earning capacity while she cared for the children, while he was able to increase his income and increase his earning capacity. So when they separated, she thought, well, this is pretty unfair. I'm only getting 50-50. I want more. I need more.
Okay, so she goes to the court and says, look, we need to put aside this binding financial agreement. And when that outcome becomes pretty clear that the judge is, you know, receptive to that idea, Mr. Daly sues the lawyers who had drafted the set-aside binding financial agreement, arguing that, what, their incompetence caused him financial harm? Well, what was he arguing?
He was arguing that he didn't get the right advice, that he didn't get the advice that the agreement should be drafted in a particular way to cover off on predicting the future, predicting the possibility that they might have children.
And the court agreed that, yeah, there probably was a basis for the document was done in a pretty dodgy way or in a leaky way, so he should be allowed to sue. And then it went all the way to the High Court about what he should be allowed to sue for.
Well, there were two aspects to why it was set aside earlier on. It was also set aside for uncertainty because the document wasn't clear. I mean, the wife was meant to get a certain payment under a certain provision of the agreement, and that provision didn't exist. So there were other things where the agreement didn't actually make sense. So the agreement was set aside for both reasons, the hardship ground and the uncertainty ground. And then when it went to the High Court, the former lawyers for the husband were trying to argue that they shouldn't be liable for his losses.
Because what?
Well, they had two arguments, really. The main one was the statute of limitations, which is, you know, if you have the right to sue somebody, that right to sue expires after a certain period of time. So the lawyers were trying to argue, well, when you entered into the agreement back in 2005, that's when your action against us arose, and it didn't arise when you separated and your wife made a claim.
And the damage or the harm or the consequences of the contract became all manifested.
That's right. So it would have been a really good outcome for the lawyers if the liability arose when the agreement was entered into, because most of these agreements last quite a period of time. So that the longer the parties are together, then they'd have no right of action against their lawyers if the cause of action arose when the agreement was entered into. But the High Court said no, the liability arises at a later time, either when the parties separate or when the wife makes a claim, sometime around those times.
But Jackie, the High Court also said, look, you can only sue, Mr. Daly, you can only sue our lawyers for the costs that you spent litigating whether or not the binding financial agreement was valid or not. You can't sue our lawyers for the worst financial situation you find yourself following the distribution of the property at the end of the marriage because the document was dodgy or wasn't watertight.
And it wasn't quite like that, Damien. It was, the High Court said you can recover your costs for the litigation in relation to the agreement being held to be uncertain. That's fine. And that was quite a small amount. You can't recover your costs, though, for the costs of having the agreement set aside for the hardship in relation to the birth of the children, or for the amount of money that you paid the wife for her property settlement claim that you wouldn't have had to pay her if the agreement had been binding. The reason why he wasn't able to recover that was not actually precisely because the document was dodgy, it was because of the way he presented his case. So if he'd presented his case in a different way, he had to go through a lot of hoops, really. And the High Court laid it out pretty clearly what he would have had to have done to have a successful claim against his lawyers and get, you know, a significant sum of money for his losses. But they were quite big hoops to jump through. So it's pretty difficult to envisage how he could have jumped through all those hoops, because what he would have had to establish to one of the lower courts was that an agreement that would have withstood the challenge would have been drafted in this possible way, a different way, and that the wife would have agreed to that. And then let's say that under that agreement she was entitled to, say, 60% rather than the 50% that she got under the agreement that she did enter into. He could then recover the difference between what he paid her in her property settlement and what she would have got under the notional pretend agreement that didn't exist.
So there was just no way of knowing. There were too many hypotheticals.
Absolutely. Although it sets out really clearly what you have to do to succeed, I think it's quite a high bar.
This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today we're looking at prenup agreements. So what do we know about the lawyers who draft these agreements and the couples who sign them? University of Technology Sydney Associate Professor Miranda Kay and her colleagues interviewed 40 family law professionals, including Jackie Campbell. Hi, Miranda. What did you learn?
Well, it was really interesting because, as you know, Damien, binding financial agreements are not kept on record anywhere. There's no registry of them. And everything we know is completely anecdotal. And so the only way to find anything about financial agreements is actually to interview the lawyers, because if we only look at the cases that go wrong, we actually don't find out the ones that work. So we thought we would interview the lawyers. There were 40 of them, and as you say, they said there were three main types of people who are proposing prenups or financial agreements before a relationship. And the first group is what we might imagine, those high net worth individuals who are seeking to protect their own wealth. The second are couples entering into second marriages or second de facto relationships who've maybe been burnt before in separating. And usually, but not always, they're wanting to protect their wealth for their own children from their last relationship. And then the third group are what we might call people from dynastic wealth. And sometimes they're required to enter into that financial agreement to protect the family wealth as opposed to their own individual wealth.
There are some very interesting quotes from your interviews, and I guess especially around that third category. quote, "It is not usually the lovebirds who decide to have one. It's the others. It's the parents." And then there was another lovely quote, "Quite often, though, they don't come in, but they are in the background. You get sent emails where mum and dad or the daughter is being copied in and things like that. So you get the idea of who the real puppet master is fairly early on," end quote. So the parents in these dynastic wealth cases, the parents do seem to be the driving force.
I think that's right. I think in some very wealthy families, it's actually a condition of staying within that family wealth arrangement to get a prenup. That's certainly what the lawyers were telling us. It's not probably the biggest group of people getting prenups in Australia. I think it is in other jurisdictions, but maybe we don't have the same number of, you know, multi-millionaires, billionaires as other countries do. I don't know.
You asked lawyers whether they thought there was a power imbalance between parties seeking to negotiate prenups. What did the lawyers tell you?
Well, most of them said yes. So I should say 31, I think, of the 40 said often or sometimes there'll be a power imbalance. 4 said there will always be. And I think only 2 said never. Those 2 that said never thought that the lawyers could rectify any power imbalance. So I think it was clear that most did think there was a power imbalance. And actually one of the barristers said, well, why would you want one unless there is unequal bargaining power?
There's some other lovely quotes where one person's got the wealth and the other's got nothing. That's the main one. If you've got the wealth, you can put the pressure on the person and say, if you don't sign, I'm not going to marry you. And there's another quote, if I see a young girl who hasn't had kids and there might be a discrepancy in their asset base, I won't do them. In other words, I won't draft the agreement.
Yes. A few lawyers were really hesitant about drafting prenups for young people, particularly young women. And I think young women are often unable to envisage how their lives might change once they've had children. I'm thinking of myself, actually. You know, when I left university, I was earning the same as my partner. If you'd asked me to do a prenup then, we'd have probably done one which is, you know, you both keep your own wealth. Well, you know, 30 plus years and 3 children later, part-time work and time out of work, that would have not worked for me.
That's not to say, of course, that binding financial agreements don't have their uses. Here's what one lawyer said, quote, "There are people for whom agreements are really helpful and suitable. People on their second marriages who have established assets and established careers, adult children and no prospect of more children. The reason they're suitable is because they give people certainty and, more importantly, they give their children certainty."
I think that is really interesting. And that was the group of people that were lawyers had much less concern about doing prenups for, those people who have already had a relationship and got their own assets. And there's just certainty about what's going to happen in the future in their lives, which you don't have with a younger couple.
We've been speaking about the High Court of Australia decision where Mr. Daly sued his own lawyer because the court threw out the prenup agreement. What did you find when you spoke to lawyers? What concerns do they have about their own liability?
All 40 of them had concerns. I mean, 9 of the 40 wouldn't do prenups, and not all because they were concerned about their own liability, but that was certainly one of the major reasons why firms won't do them. Even the firms that do them that we talk to, and I have to stress we talk to family law specialists, and many of whom were from what I'd call the top end of town, would only have one partner in the firm or 2 people who really just concentrated on financial agreements and really knew their way around them. But all of the lawyers we talked to had concerns about negligence actions. I think they described them. There were various kind of terms they use: hidden landmines, ticking time bombs, and skeleton in the closet. And I think the Daly case actually illustrates that really well. I mean, that was 15 years after the lawyer drafted the prenup that Mrs. Daly applied to set it aside. So, you know, these things hang around or can for a very long time.
And she did so successfully. She convinced the judge that her circumstances had changed. You know, there were now 2 children from the marriage, and this agreement signed way back in 2005, I think it was, just wasn't going to work for anybody.
No, it wasn't. And I think that the lawyers, we asked them if they'd had any complaints or actions brought against them. And I have to say, I think all of them from memory said no, but they all also added, fingers crossed, hope not, because these things are sitting there, you know. And the Daly case is a perfect example of one that, you know, that they're not statute barred. They can hang around for a long time. And so lawyers will have been watching that case with interest, I think.
One of the other quotes jumped out at me. Binding financial agreements are the only thing that we can get properly sued for in family law matters, so everyone's wary of it.
Yes, that very much came across. What also came across was that lawyers were really concerned about other lawyers who were acting on financial agreements. So, as I said, we tended to talk to, because of the way we recruited our family lawyers through the family law section of the Law Council, we tended to get very experienced family lawyers. Most of them had over 20 years, or half of them had over 20 years experience in family law. But many of them had seen really shockingly drafted financial agreements during their time in practice. And some of them talked about dabblers, lawyers being dabblers in financial agreements, and generally that is not a good idea. You really need to be a specialist doing these things because you can be sued.
In your interviews with the lawyers, did they tell you what the response from the party who is asked to sign the document, which would normally be the person with the smaller asset base or from a less affluent family, were they resentful?
It really varies, I think. And some of the lawyers only acted giving advice. They didn't actually draft the financial agreements, and they would tend to be on the other side. And many of those lawyers were very protective of the person who'd come in with the draft. But it would vary enormously. Some of them knew what they were, the kind of person that they were, you know, family they were marrying into, and were prepared for it. And others were simply not prepared and were prepared to sign anything.
In your paper, lawyers said that a lot of the young women didn't want to appear to be gold diggers.
Yes, that is really interesting, isn't it? And I think that's even more so when the family is behind the prenup. They don't want to be seen as a gold digger or only marrying the son, usually for money. And I think in those cases, there's even more pressure for them to sign and to not query the prenup.
Miranda, what did the lawyers tell you about the involvement of third parties, specifically the parents? Did the lawyers involve the parents in meetings with the client, I guess the person who's about to get married, when drafting the agreement? And were there different views about whether or not that was appropriate?
There actually were very different views. So some were happy to have the parents in the room. They actually found it helpful to get the background to what was going on. And others would be very clear that the client is the person who, you know, is the party to the prenup and didn't want the parents in the room at all. But quite often the parents would be paying the bill, but they had to stress that the client is actually the party to the prenup.
So they're paying the bill for the drafting of the prenup agreement for the benefit of their child, but are they also paying for the independent legal advice that is required under the Act for the other person before they sign the agreement?
Sometimes, yes, the proposer of the prenup will sometimes be paying for the independent advice of the other party. And that might sound terrible, but actually, Damien, I don't think it is. I think you want that other party to be having good legal advice, and if they couldn't otherwise afford it, I think sometimes it works well for the proposer to be paying the advice on both sides. Lawyers will still ensure that the advice is independent, even if someone else is paying their bill.
And of course, they are different lawyers, aren't they? They're not the same person.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's what very important, that both parties has to have their own lawyer advising on their own interests.
I'm thinking back to the case, which is the most important decision from the High Court around binding financial agreements, Thorne and Kennedy. Do you remember that case?
I do, yes. And I think it probably is the case. Lawyers have become much more cautious after Thorne and Kennedy, if they weren't being before.
And that was a case where I think there was a Gold Coast property developer in his 60s who met a woman from Eastern Europe who was living in the Middle East, half his age, and encouraged her to move to Australia. Then I think in the weeks before the marriage, after all the arrangements were made, basically sprung it on her and said, look, you're going to have to sign this agreement. And I know that the independent legal advisor in that case said to this woman, don't sign. This is the worst agreement I've ever seen. But she felt pressured.
She used those words, I think. This is the worst agreement I've ever seen. She gave it impeccable legal advice, that lawyer.
She certainly did. But the woman still felt pressured to go on with the marriage. I think even her status as in the country was totally dependent on this relationship. And she had no assets. Her family had already flown in from Eastern Europe. You know, everything was ready to go. She signed. But then she was able to have that agreement overturned ultimately, wasn't she?
She was, and the High Court actually did it on the basis of unconscionable dealing by the proposer of the prenup and also the majority by undue influence, because she really had no choice. They actually did financial agreements again just after the marriage. He thought that was a kind of belt and braces approach if we do it after the marriage, and the High Court set those aside as well.
Even though there were no children in the marriage, I understand.
There were no children in the marriage. And I think the agreement was so ungenerous, that's being kind. I think the agreement gave her only $50,000 after 3 years of marriage. And this was a man with, I think he had assets of around 18 to 24 million or something dollars. So the fact that the agreement was so unfair, I'm sure, played in the minds of all the judges deciding that case.
So what happens if a prenup is actually watertight? Do lawyers always encourage their clients to play hardball? Here's Jackie Campbell again.
For the wealthier client, the person who's in the stronger financial position, often that is the male, I'll be reminding them that if you separate in 10 years' time and you've got children, do you want your wife to be living hundreds of miles away, or do you want them to be living close by so that you can have an ongoing shared parenting arrangement with your children?
So you're basically saying you might have the wealth to live in a wealthy suburb, but you know, your ex-partner and the kids will be travelling back and forwards.
Yes.
They might be 30 kilometres away in a less affluent suburb.
Yes, and that you might actually have a better relationship with your children and your spouse if you provide properly for them now. Depending on the size of the asset pool, I mean, it varies, because sometimes people come to see you and the pool's pretty modest. But if you're acting for someone where the pool's quite big, then you can talk to them about, well, buying them a house in the same suburb that the matrimonial home's in. Or they keep the matrimonial home and you move somewhere else but you live close by. Just the practicalities of it. And I also think that if a matter comes before the court on a challenge, of whatever sort of challenge, if the person has the primary care of the children and who might be in the weaker financial position has housing, then the court's less likely to be troubled by the agreement and be looking for things to set it aside, but also your ex-wife's less likely to challenge it. So you want to set it up so that, okay, your ex-wife may not be getting what she would have got if the matter was decided by the court under Section 79, the normal property settlement principles. But it's enough that she's going to think, oh, well, it's okay, I can survive on this and life's okay, and life would be harder if I was going to court and having a fight about it. So you want to leave them in a position where they're happy to accept what they get under the agreement rather than looking for a way to challenge it, because they can be challenged in lots of different ways that we can't predict now because the law changes too and the way the case law has developed. So you want to try to protect your client from a challenge that you can't predict.
Right. And I spoke with Miranda Kay about the classic case of undue influence or unconscionable conduct. That was the Thorne and Kennedy case. Do you ever come across those sorts of issues in your practice?
Absolutely. I think most lawyers are pretty wary of when you're acting for a client who might be subject to undue influence, unconscionable conduct. So unfair pressure is sort of a good general term to talk about there. And if it's combined with a bad bargain, and that was the word that was used by the trial judge in Thorne and Kennedy, it's not a very good combination. So some lawyers will sign the Statement of Independent Legal Advice in any event, but my practice is not to do that. I would be trying to encourage my client to give a better settlement for the other party.
Do you ever advise people, do you ever play the role of independent legal advisor and say, don't sign this document?
Well, that's my job. If I don't think the client is getting a good enough deal under the agreement, then I will say, don't sign it. And if you want to enter into it, there'll be times when I say, well, go somewhere else. If you won't let me negotiate a better deal for you, then go and see another lawyer. Sue them rather than me.
Really? There are issues around liability for you, but also about what's in the best interest of the person who's coming before
you. Oh, absolutely. And I think I'd feel that it was not the right thing for me to be doing as a lawyer, to be signing off on an agreement that I thought was so bad that they shouldn't be entering into it. I would much rather be trying to negotiate them a better deal. But I also am worried about the liability issue. I mean, even if I'm found not to be liable and I don't have a damages claim made against me or have to pay costs, it's still stressful being sued. So I don't want to end up in litigation about whether or not I've been negligent. I'd rather get a better deal for my client in the first place.
Jackie Campbell, partner with Melbourne law firm Forte Family Lawyers, and before her, UTS Associate Professor Miranda Kay. That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer this week, Riley Mellis. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.